We're beginning Parshas Vayigash, and although the Parsha is very serious, I sense that you guys are even more serious. So we're going to begin with a story. There's once a Jew who came to Shul, and he didn't know too much. So he's standing and he hears them reading the Torah, and he wants to read along. And every time his chumash has two yuds next to one next to the other, which is another way of writing Hashem's name. So he's trying to read the parasha, and he reads it, and he reaches Hashem's name, and he reads Yiyah. So the guy standing next to him hears him going Yiyah. A few seconds later, Yiyah. So the guy standing next to him says, "Listen here. Anytime you see two dots like this, it's not Yiyah. It's Hashem's name, and this is how you pronounce it." So the guy says, "That's nice. Two dots is Hashem's name. Okay." They come up to Shmona Esrei. And in Shmona Esrei, every time you have the end of a sentence, so you have a colon, two dots, one on top of the other. So every sentence he finishes, he says Hashem's name. So the guy standing next to him hears him. And he says, "Buddy, what you doing?" He says, "You told me, anytime I have two dots, one by the other, so that's Hashem's name. So here, you see, at the end of each sentence, you have Hashem's name, so I'm saying it." So he says, "No, you want to understand, it's like this. The two dots are two yuds, and they're like two Jews. Two Jews, when they're standing one on top of the other, then Hashem's not there. When they're standing one next to the other, that's when Hashem's there. So when you have the two dots, one next to the other, that's when it's Hashem's name. When it's one on top of the other, that's not Hashem's name." So our parsha, on that note, our parsha is about two Jews standing next to one another. But there is a fierce, fierce discussion between them, which really is about who's going to be on top. And our parsha has so many levels of interpretation. If you have time and you could find a good chavrusa, take the Akedas Yitzchak. He wrote a phenomenal work, a phenomenal philosophical work. And on our parsha, he describes on a very deep level what's going on between the king of Israel, Yehuda, and Yosef, who on the surface is being portrayed as the viceroy of Egypt, but is really representing another force within Israel, the force of Mashiach ben Yosef. And these two forces, on the one hand, are two forces of leadership within the Jewish people, but they're two forces which have different roles, complementary roles, which sometimes become competitive. Our sages tell us that had things played themselves out the way they should have, then Mashiach ben Yosef should have been none other than our first king, Saul, Shaul, who was a descendant of Rachel. So that should have been Mashiach ben Yosef, and the one to come and finish it off, Mashiach ben David, was to be David himself. But instead of there being a cohesion where the two work together, Mashiach ben Yosef, Shaul, saw David as his nemesis. Instead of seeing the blessing that it's his own son-in-law who's going to take the throne, if it couldn't be his son, at least it's his son-in-law. No! What Shaul saw was a threat. Can't let this happen. So he chases David. He tries to kill David. Now, he isn't taken to task over it because he was plagued. He had a psychological problem. The Navi clearly says, "Bi'atatu ruach ra'a." Hashem had a bad spirit plague him. So the commentary is right. Melancholia. They describe that he had a problem with depression. So we don't hold him to task. His failures were not when he was chasing David. His failures were personal in his leadership of Israel. But I'm just bringing this to see an example of where the descendants of Rachel and the descendants of Leah, each with their own force, could work in unison and advance the Jewish people, or could stand opposing one another. And this is one level of interpretation that we will not explore tonight. You're welcome to see the Akedas Yitzchak. Our parsha again has so many levels of interpretation. It is, in my mind, the most fascinating parsha in the Torah. I think this is the parsha. If you want to open a Midrash, says, if you want to take an hour and just enjoy reading Midrashim on the parsha, this is the one. This is, in my mind, this is it. And the parsha really is the climax of the book of Bereishis. Parshas Vayechi is in its own realm. It's a parsha of song. It's a parsha of the passing of Yaakov. It's a parsha that's really the joint between Bereishis and Shmos. That's Parshas Vayechi. Vayechi and Shmos are two parshas that are the joints. Vayechi being a lot of closing chapters, you know, the final discussion between Yosef and his brothers, the final discussion between Yaakov and the tribes, the final burial of Yaakov, that's all going to be in Vayechi. That's closing the chapter. But the climax of the book of Bereishis is Parshas Vayigash. We have 12 tribes. We have 12 tribes that have faltered. We have 12 tribes that have sold their brother, lied to their father, with correct intent. They meant well, but they did wrong. You have Yosef, who has developed a life of his own. Yosef, whose own father questions his integrity. His father will never kiss him. From the day they meet again to the day Yaakov dies, he will never kiss Yosef. He will always wonder, what were you up to those 22 years? Yosef has to live a life where he isn't trusted. His brothers, his own father, and Yosef overcomes all of that. Yosef is still Yosef HaTzadik. We don't say Yehuda HaTzadik. We don't say Reuven HaTzadik. 12 great tribes, but only one's called the Tzadik. It's Yosef. And that's what we discussed earlier. We had a class about the light. You guys remember the teacher that came in, drew a dot, circles. We did this here, no? Did it a few times. Were you here? Okay. This is an important class, so we'll do it. We'll do it in short. Teacher walks into class, says, I want you guys to hear the lesson of a lifetime. Takes a piece of paper, puts it on the blackboard, takes his marker, dips it in the ink, takes the brush, and puts a dot in the center of the paper, and starts making circles, drawing circles around the dot. And as he's drawing, the paintbrush has less and less paint on it, until finally he reaches the outskirts of the page, the canvas, and he's drawing really wisps of black, until finally there's nothing left. There's just white. And he says to the students, tell me, where is there the most light? And they point to the different corners of the canvas where it's white and shiny, and where is there the least light? Where is it the darkest? So they point to the center, that black dot. And then he says, now watch this. And he pushes a button, and a light turns on behind the black dot. He says, now tell me, where is there the most light? So they say, okay, big deal. So now you did a trick. Behind the black dot, there's light. He said, no, I want you to understand what happened here. When I first asked you where there's the most light, you pointed to the white parts of the paper. Those are areas where the most light is being reflected. That's what you see when you see white. When I said, where is there the least light, you pointed to the dark center, and that's where the least light is reflected, and that's why you see black. But when I turned on a light, then you had a real source of light. And then that darkest center, that's where you really had light. Now that's a lesson in life, because in life, we spend a lot of life reflecting. We hear what people say about us. We hear how people describe us. We hear people's appreciation of us. And that gives us identity. They say I'm a nice guy. They say they like me. They say I'm smart. They say I'm kind. They say I'm handsome. We develop our identity based on society. 500 years ago, if a woman looked like a woman today, they'd say she was sick. No one would marry her. Only if she was extraordinarily fat was she considered beautiful. You see in the Talmud, they tell you Cusbi, yes, the Midianite girl who came with the intent to seduce Moshe Rabbeinu. So the Talmud says, you know how gorgeous she was? She extended from one end of the room to two rooms down. She was the beauty. You can't imagine how beautiful she was. That's okay, in Talmudic terms, that's saying she's beautiful. Now go explain that to a woman today. Now a woman from today would show up in the days, even 500 years ago. They'd look at her and say, you're sick, go get to the hospital. What's wrong with you? How do we consider ourselves beautiful? If we match to what society considers beautiful. 500 years ago, that meant one thing. Today, it means something else. In some societies, it means one thing. In other societies, it means something else. So the Chinese think that if a woman has small boxcar legs, that's gorgeous. Okay? And in some places in Africa, if you have earlobes that hang down to your shoulders, that's gorgeous. Okay? To each his own. But we're reflecting what society's telling us. And that can work for much of life. Until society starts telling you, you're bad, you're nothing. Until you look around and there's no one shining on you. You could be in a college campus where they're saying, Israel's bad, Jews are bad. You could be in the UN. You could be in Holland, in Denmark. Oh. So you sometimes find yourself in situations where no one around you is saying anything good about you. And that's when you have to make a choice. Are you going to turn on that light within you and shine? Or are you going to be a reflection of what everyone else is shining on you? And if you turn on that light, then that's when you start being great. And that was Yosef HaTzadik. That was the strength of Yosef. No one was saying anything good about him. His brothers said, you're worthless. You're the Esav in the family. Just like Esav had to be gotten rid of, and Yaakov did everything to bump him off, you're out. Yishmael was kicked out, Esav was kicked out, Yosef's kicked out. You have a bunch of uncles and great uncles just like you. You belong in Egypt. So he's purchased by an Egyptian, and the Egyptians look down at the Hebrews. They wouldn't eat with the Hebrew at the same table. Every other slave got better treatment. Who was the lowest of the low? The Hebrews. Can't make it to the Egyptian table. You sit down there. And Yosef is faithful, and Yosef is honest, and Yosef continues dedicated, and his master has no choice but to realize, hey, this guy's good. Yes?
Who are the Hebrews? I mean, wasn't it just Yaakov and the family? How did they even know about... Were there other people who were also...
If the word Hebrew means those that came from the other side of the Euphrates, which is the simple meaning of the word Hebrew, Meishon Ivri, Eiver HaNahar... So then that would seem to be the Hebrews.
So it wasn't just this family that were...
That's what would seem to be. We had a long class on this once, and if you want to bring it up tomorrow night, we could have a long class about it again. But for a short answer, that's a good short answer.
If we don't have that class tomorrow, then we're the Hebrews, is it online somewhere?
Yes. We addressed it in a Q&A about 3 years ago.
So it would be on Monday?
No, it might be on Machon Meir. It'll be on 123Torah.com. On Machon Meir, I don't know. But on 123Torah, it'll be under the Q&A. We had a class either what does the word he... Who were the Hebrews? That's what it should be under. I hope. So Yosef has been contending with brothers. The aristocracy of Egyptian society says, what a lowlife. He tries to cheat with his master's wife. He's in prison. And you see, even the Egyptian prisoner who he helped makes a point of speaking badly about him. But Yosef continues being faithful. Yosef's own father won't kiss him because he doesn't know what's he been up to for 22 years. He's in the most morally corrupt country of the world at the time. And he's a good-looking young man. And Yaakov comes down to Egypt. Oh, he's all set up. He has a wife and two kids. Everything's nice. How many mistresses does he have? Yaakov doesn't know, and he knows he doesn't know. So Yaakov's view of Yosef is, okay, I have to honor you, I have to respect you, you're the king, and I appreciate what you've done for me, but I really don't know what you're up to. So Yosef is in this position his whole life, and he's still a shining light. Yosef HaTzadik. And now Yosef HaTzadik is going to meet with the king, the lion of the tribes. If there's one leader, if there's one Torah authority in the family, it's Yehuda. If there's one who steps to the plate when everyone else doesn't know what to do, it's Yehuda. And if there's one who came up and said, sell him, it's Yehuda. All the brothers were saying, we'll kill him, we'll leave him to die. Yehuda says, what do we gain out of it? Sell him down to Egypt. So Yehuda is the one who really put him in this predicament. And now, Yosef sets up the brothers. So, the brothers come to him, they need food, he sells them food, he puts the money back in their sacks, they go back, suddenly they see the money in their sacks, what's going on here, what's wrong, wait a second, we know we paid, now they're going to claim we stole. So he puts the brothers on edge, he tells them you guys are spies. Now the brothers come back a second time, he tells them don't show up here without bringing your little brother. They sit down, he has a meal with them, he shows them he knows exactly how to shecht an animal. He shows them, he tells his son, you shecht that animal and show them you did a good job. The brothers are standing there awestruck. They're sitting during the meal and Yosef starts saying, Shimon, wow, you had the lower bunk. Reuven, you always drove him crazy from the upper bunk. He was sitting there telling them things from when they were little kids. They start looking at one another saying, wow, this guy's some magician. How does he know everything?
How do they not recognize him?
Oh, Yosef put on a good act. Don't forget, when they left Yosef, he was pretty boy 17. He had curls coming out here. He was a pretty boy and 17. Now they're coming back. He has a full-grown beard. He has all the Egyptian garb on him. And he doesn't talk their language. He's talking Egyptian. Everything's through translator.
But the Shechita is also from a boy. I mean,
it's his son. They never met his son.
No, but how can they get the... How, you're saying he showed them that he knew how to slaughter. But
right.
They're going, like,
right, but so were they. They weren't Jewish yet either. Right?
So then why did they have to...
They were careful about Shechita. But, okay, right. It's an interesting...
From the oral tradition and our Sinai. That was something that they didn't know before.
Like you said two things. Oral tradition from Sinai, yes. That they didn't know before, well, it seems pretty clear they did. From multiple sources. From Bereishis. At any rate, so the brothers leave. Yosef sends his son Menashe charging after them. He comes up with a whole battalion and he says, what's wrong with you people? We treated you so well. We were so nice to you. What are you doing stealing my master's goblet for? You didn't think he'd figure it out. So they say, what do you mean? We're so honest. We brought back extra money. You've mistakenly put back money. We brought back the money. He says, you liars, you thieves. Empties out their bags. And finally, the final bag, you know, it's only on the last bag. There's the goblet, Benjamin. What do the brothers do? They turn on Benjamin again. You thief, the son of a thief. Mother was a thief, she died for it. You're a thief. Now you got us all into trouble. Benjamin's silent. Doesn't say I didn't steal it. How could he say I didn't steal it? They said you're a thief. The son of a thief. Now if he says, no, I'm not a thief, what's he saying? But my mother is. He can't deny that his mother stole something. He knows he didn't.
What did she steal?
She stole her father's truffin. She wanted to ensure her father wouldn't worship idols, so when they left her father Lavan's house, she stole his idols. So Yaakov had said, whoever stole it will die. So she did die shortly thereafter. But Benjamin can't say a word. So the brothers are looking down at Benjamin, and he's quiet. He can't say anything. And they promised Dad, we'll bring him back. We'll bring him back. Yehuda says, I'm responsible. If I don't bring him back, that's it. I've lost it for life. Now, we'll pick up in 1 second. Yeah.
How did Yosef know that it wouldn't turn into a bloodbath after he sent Menashe and the Egyptians? Because, I mean, they've done, the brothers have killed people before, and he knows, like, with with Shem and had, like, what if they would have killed Menashe?
So the Midrash says two things. One Midrash says that when Shimon was imprisoned, so Shimon said, "You want me to go to jail? Put me there." And Midrash says that they called in a bunch of Egyptian soldiers, and Shimon roared at them, and their teeth started falling out, and they ran away. So Yosef said, "Enough of that." And he sent his son Menashe and said, "Put him in a headlock and put him in jail." And Menashe grabbed Shimon, put him in a headlock, and put him in jail. And Shimon, the brother, said to him, "Shimon, where are you, man?" Shimon said, "This is from our family. This is strength that I only seen in our house." Remember, the Midrash we discussed, no? The Midrash says that the rock that Yaakov Avinu set, what they call the Dome of the Rock, right? Did you ever see how big that rock is? It's about the size of this building, right? So that's a rock which the Midrash says Yosef picked up with one hand and put down in the floor. When God appears to Lavan on the night that Lavan's chasing Yaakov, God says to Lavan, "I don't have to interfere. You have to understand who your son-in-law is. You're chasing after a man who lifted with one hand a rock this size." And God shows him the rock that Yaakov established as the rock, as which is now under the Dome of the Rock, right? That big rock. Right. That big rock. So he says, "He could take care of you without my help. But I'm telling you, don't get involved with him. Leave him alone." So Yaakov's family was extraordinarily strong. We see it with Shimon and Levi. So now, one Midrash says that Menashe was extraordinarily strong too. So when Menashe comes chasing after Shimon, comes chasing after the 12 tribes with his soldiers, he's already told them once, "You guys don't realize what you're up against." But there's another Midrash which raises a point like you said. And the Midrash, we'll see in a few minutes. Well, I'll just jump to the end of the Midrash. The end of the Midrash is that Yosef was very lucky because the story didn't have to end the way it did. Meaning the Midrash says he was seconds away from being killed by Yehuda. And then his whole story would have been buried. You know, the brothers would have had to run, and the whole story would have had a different ending. The Midrash says that when Yosef left himself alone in the room with the brothers, he has a lot to be thankful for that the story ended the way it did. So the Midrash does entertain this question from a different angle, that really it could have ended differently, right? That's a good point.
Midrash and Midrash
are the same. Yeah.
They didn't end differently.
So Yehuda is going to take a step forward, and Yehuda says, "Listen here, I know this country. You guys are the most immoral people, and there's a reason why you're looking at the little one, the good-looking one. You're interested in him for improper activities, and I'm not going to put up with this." So Yosef says, "Yehuda, why don't we have a talk, you and I? Let's go for a walk." So Yehuda says, "I'm going to roar. And, I have a fire burning within me that will destroy this city." And what he meant to say, he says, you have to realize my two brothers, they destroyed the whole city of Shechem. You have to understand what you're up against here, Tzofnas Paneach. Yosef says, "I hear you have a fire burning within you." Now, what Yehuda meant by a fire burning within me is, "I feel that halachically, you guys all deserve to be killed because you're taking him to sleep with him. That's why you want my brother Binyamin. And we killed the whole city over raping our sister. If you think you're going to do that to our brother, you can forget it." So Yosef says to Yehuda, "You have an interesting fire burning within you. I think it's the fire of Tamar that's been rekindled." In other words, Yosef is saying to Yehuda, "You went with a woman of ill repute. Who are you to start talking to me about moral and immoral activity?" How did Yosef know about that? Yosef had his spies everywhere. Yosef says to you, so Yehuda says, "If you keep this up, I'm going to draw my sword." And Yosef says, "You draw your sword, I'm going to wrap it around your neck. Yehuda says, I'm going to, now I'm quoting to you the Medrash, meaning the Medrash says these words. Yehuda says, I'm going to open my mouth, and when I shut it, you're going to be in it. Yosef says, you're going to open your mouth, you're going to have stones in your mouth. You're not. I'm going to shut your mouth. Yehuda says, you know, my two brothers, we're going to divide up the city, my brothers and I. There, he sends Naphtali, he says, go count up how many marketplaces there are in Egypt. And he comes back and tells him 12. So Yehuda says, fine. You guys take 6, I'll take 6. Yehuda turns to Yosef and says, listen here. If I just tell them, if I just give them the sign, we will paint all of Egypt in blood. Yosef says, you guys are really good painters. You painted your brother's garment in blood. You brought that to your father. I see you're good at this painting business, Yehuda. What's Yosef telling him? You're assuming you have the merits you had when you took up on Shechem, Yehuda. You don't have those merits. You have 22 years of sin on your back. 22 years of what you did to your brother. 22 years of what you did to your father. Don't go telling me you're going to paint Egypt like you painted Shechem. You're not where they were at Shechem. They could be zealous over rape. You who went with the woman of ill repute, who are you? They could be zealous. They didn't have the sin of selling a brother. You're going to come here and you think you're going to be victorious? You think you're on the level they were at? So the Medrash describes it in very vivid terms. The commentaries automatically say it's not just a fight of words. You know, I'll do this, but you did that. It's really a question where Yosef is telling him, don't tell me you feel halachically, spiritually, morally, ethically, you have a right to do something. You don't. You're not where you think you are. Yehuda says, look, I'm finished with discussing this with you. We're going to destroy Egypt now. Yosef says, you better think twice, because Egypt isn't Shechem. Shechem was a city in Israel. Egypt? Well, Egypt is the source of sustenance for the world right now. You destroy Egypt, you're destroying the source of sustenance for the world. You sure you want to do that, Yehuda? Yehuda sees he's not getting anywhere. So Yehuda starts roaring, and the Medrash says that when Yehuda's yelling, so there were a few things that happened. One is he started thumping with his foot on the floor, and the ground of Egypt would shake. Two, he had a nephew, Hushim, the son of Dun, who was deaf, back in Israel. And when Yehuda would roar, so Hushim heard it. So the Medrash says, Hushim, back in Israel, said, oh, Uncle Yehuda's in trouble. We got to round up the guys. There's a problem brewing. So Yehuda is standing in front of Yosef. There's a fantastic Medrash that says that when Yehuda would get upset, he'd take a block of lead, put it in between his teeth and start grinding it in his mouth. And as he was chewing the lead, so he'd have lead dripping down his cheek. And he had one eyeball that would go bloody. And he'd look at Yosef chewing lead and have blood dripping mixing with the lead. And he looked at Yosef. The Medrash even says he had a hair on his chest that Yehuda used to wear many talisim. That was a talis, really, is like a cape. If you look in ancient times, all the Romans who were people of importance had nice capes, right? What do all the superheroes have in common? Batman, Wonder Man, Superman, Spider-Man, they all have capes, right?
Spider-Man, no.
Spider-Man doesn't? Okay, see, I'm out of touch. Okay. But in my day, he might have had a cape. I don't know about today's Spider-Man. At any rate, a cape. So a talis is really like a cape. It's a garment of honor. So Yehuda had many capes. He had many garments. And the Medrash says that when he'd get upset, so he had a hair on his chest that would stand up like a sword and protrude through all the garments. And so this is the picture the Medrash portrays of Yehuda standing opposite Yosef. So that's one Medrash. You guys should know. Like I said, this is the climax. We've reached the point where everything the forefathers have built is at a juncture. The strength of Yosef is coming to play. The strength of Yehuda is coming to play. And Yehuda has to face off with Yosef.
What is the purpose of a medrash? Because it seems to...
Tomorrow night. Okay. We got 15 minutes left and we haven't even started the parsha yet. So, Yosef, Yehuda says to Yosef, okay, you cornered me. He starts crying. So, Yosef brought Yehuda to his knees. Yehuda says, what am I supposed to do? I promised Dad I'm going to bring him back. What am I going to do when I come home? How am I going to see my father? After everything he's been through, now his last son from his chosen wife is going to be gone? Yosef says, well, tell him that the son did just like the mother. The mother was a thief and died for it. The son was a thief. Just tell him that. So Yehuda says, how could I do that? Yosef says, what'd you do when you sold your other brother? Just make up a story like you did then. And this is the point Yosef wanted to bring them to. Yosef wanted to bring the brothers to a point where the brothers would have to rectify what they did to him. And the only way to do that was to corner them to a point where they'd have no choice but to put their own lives on the line rather than turn their back on a brother. So he sets up the whole scene so that now Benjamin deserves it. He's the thief. And the only reason not to do it is not for Benjamin. It's for their father. It's because he's their brother. But Benjamin, he deserves it. He's cornered Benjamin to the point where Benjamin can't say anything. And the brothers are convinced he's guilty. And the brothers are going to now step forward and say, we're going to do anything but give up on Benjamin. And so in Yosef's brilliance, what he's done in this whole story is brought the brothers to a point where they give up. They say, you're right. We have nothing to say. I have nothing I can say legitimately. He's in the wrong. And I'm in the wrong. But I can't give up on him anyways. And once Yosef's brought them to that point, game over. That's it. And that's what Yosef does. He says, you know, you guys, you came here looking for someone. Your brother, right? That's what you keep saying. Because I had my men follow you, and you were all around the brothels of town. You didn't take any business, but you were checking them all out. Why? So initially I told you, you're doing it because you're spies. You're trying to find all the lowlifes, to get all the secrets, to find out all the information. You went through every marketplace of town. You went through all the slave trade. You went everywhere searching. Why? So you told me, you kept telling me, you had this brother Yosef. Well, I have a surprise for you. I know where Yosef is. So the brother stands silent and stunned. He says, you want him? They say, of course we want him. That's what we came here for. So he says, okay. He asks everyone to leave the room. And he says, okay, just a second. Yosef, I want you to come in here now. So the brothers look in one direction. They look down the hall. He says, Yosef, do me a favor. There are people here waiting for you. They're looking. He doesn't come. He goes to the other side of the room and he says, Yosef, there are people here waiting for you. I want you to come. So they start looking in the other direction. And he takes them to every angle, every direction. And they're looking and they don't understand what's the point of this game. Finally, he says, you know what? He's right here. They look to the right. They look to the left. They look up. They look down. They say, what are you talking about? Where is he? He says, he's right here. Ani Yosef. Game over. Two words. Now, Rabbi Ort once told me a beautiful thought that I think is a thought that a person has to have in his back pocket in all of life. Where were the brothers a minute before, and where were the brothers a minute after? 1 minute they're standing facing this evil dictator who has cornered them. He's imprisoned one of their brothers. He's calling all the shots. He's the one that has the food. He's the top sorcerer. He can figure out everything. And they have no way out. They're between their father and this ruler, and he really hates them. He really has it in for them. He tries to be nice, but now at all, now he must be an anti-Semite, right? So 1 second, the world looks as black as can be. Remember, the brothers had said, "We'll all be your slaves, just let him go." A second later, with two words, the whole story, the last year and a half, makes sense. Now they understand. Oh, it took him time to digest, but with two words, suddenly you see the puppeteer. Suddenly you understand the whole play that's been playing out until now suddenly makes sense. Two words, Ani Yosef. And very often we stand in life, we're dealing with terrible hardships, and we ask ourselves, how could this change? When the brothers were standing there, you would have asked them, how much money you want to give me to make everything look much better? They'd say, I give you everything. But they'd ask, how could you make it better? How could you ever get out of this? How are we going to resolve this? It's going to be better and perfect? Nah, can't be. Yes, it can be. Two words, and suddenly the mask is off, and everything makes sense. Well, you know what? All of our life is that way. We deal with hardships, and we have no clue what we're doing. We have no clue, no concept. Why does this have to happen to me? Why? I'll tell you a small story from my life. I was finally offered a date with a girl I'd been trying to get set up with. I'd been chasing after this rabbi to set me up with the girl, and I finally agreed, and I was, and the rabbi's wife was supposed to get back to me with an answer from this girl, and a guy walks up to me and says, "She's waiting for your phone call." And I said, "Who?" And he said, "Your wife." And I said, "If you know her, why didn't you tell me who she was beforehand?" But I said, "I'm sorry, I already agreed to go out with this girl the rabbi had set me up with." And he said, "Well, I don't know, but she's waiting for your phone call." So I said, "You never spoke to me. It's very nice that you tried setting me up with the girl, but I already agreed. The rabbi said he's setting me up with this girl." He said, "Look, I don't want to hurt the girl's feeling, but I don't know, go see what you can do." So I trudge over to the rabbi's house and I say, "There's been some kind of misunderstanding. I really don't know what happened, but this guy set me up with another girl, and I don't know, he for some reason, the girl is waiting for my phone call. I'm the first guy she's supposed to date, and I don't know anything about her, but I'm not going to hurt a girl's feelings. I'm the first guy she's supposed to date. I'm not going to do this to her. Suddenly, I'm going to say no just because there's been a misunderstanding. Do me a favor. We have to call off this shit. I'm not going to say no." So he said, "Fine." He had his wife call up the girl and explain to her. Fine. So they call off the shidduch. And I come back to the guy and I say, "Okay, now tell me who's this girl." He says, "I don't know. Call my wife. She'll give you the number." So, fine. I'm the first guy she's dating, and I'm married to her till today. But when they set me up with her, I didn't know anything. I didn't know who I was going out with. I was set up to go with the girl I'd been wanting to go out with for ages. And I dumped her because, you know, I wasn't going to hurt her feelings. But I didn't know who my wife was. I didn't look into her. It wasn't a brilliance like, that makes sense. No. Misunderstanding. Now come, you'd ask me that day, I'd say, "Okay, you know, the Rabban Shalom led me this way, we'll make it work, whatever. Havai, something good comes of it, right?" Okay? We don't know. We don't know where we're headed. And sometimes you have to realize two words are going to change the whole picture. But we don't know when the two words are going to come. Sometimes they only come post-mortem. So the brothers had it, Ani Yosef, and the whole world changes. Yeah? Yes?
Why did they believe him when he said Ami Yosef?
They didn't.
He showed him
that his circumcision was different than all the Egyptian circumcision. There's a Jewish way to circumcise and an Egyptian way to circumcise. So his was different. And he showed him that he spoke their language. And then it all made sense. And he showed them that he remembered all the Torah his father had taught him. So now he was able to start talking to them Torah. So Yosef bursts out crying and he says, now tell me, is my father alive? I know you said it until now, but until now you lied a lot too. Because when they repeat the story, they start stuttering. They say, you know, we told you all along, we're 12 kids and one's dead. Yosef standing there, I'm the one that's dead, right? They didn't say he was dead, but now that they're stuttering and they're under pressure, they start changing stories. They're scared. They'll say there's one somewhere, so they're scared. Yosef's going to tell them, well, you're willing to give up on one, give up on another. So they're trying to cover up. So Yosef says, I know you told me my father's alive, but is he really alive? So they tell him yes, and Yosef says, don't be upset you sold me here, because I now realize, just like you now realize this whole story that I played before you was a story, I now realize that my last 22 years were so that you would have sustenance and the world would have sustenance. There was a purpose. There was God's hand guiding me down here to ensure that there'd be sustenance to the world. And Yosef tries to comfort them. And then the brothers start talking to him. He talks to them. He gives them gifts. And he sends a message back to his father. And the message that he sends is, the last lesson you taught me is the lesson that you don't leave a person alone. When I left your house, you accompanied me. And so I'm sending you wagons to accompany you, to bring you back to Egypt. I can't leave. My position doesn't allow me to leave. But I will show you it's me, because I will send you the wagons to accompany you down to Egypt. And his father is sitting at home. And Asher, right? We know one of the 12 tribes is Asher. Asher has a stepdaughter, his wife's daughter, that he brought up. She's known as Serach, Serach Bas Asher. This is really Asher's stepdaughter. It's his adopted daughter. But in Judaism, when you adopt a child, when you bring up a child, when you educate a child, any one of those three causes that the child is named after that person. It's considered that person's child. So she's called Serach Bas Asher, even though technically she wasn't his biological daughter. So they send Serach to Yaakov's house, and she starts playing music and singing a song that Yosef's still alive. They don't want to break the news suddenly to him. And Yaakov hears her singing the song, and he says, stop with that nonsense. It's been 22 years, he's dead. So she says, really? I don't know, maybe he's still alive. And she continues singing, Yosef's still alive. And after a few minutes, he realizes she's singing that same song again. So he says, stop, I told you, it's not true, he's dead. We got to come to terms, he's dead. So she says, really? No, maybe he's still alive, I'm not sure. Okay. A minute later, she starts singing the song again. And the idea was to get him prepared for the news. The brothers come back and they say, guess what? The king who's been giving us all this trouble, it was game. Yosef is still alive and he's ruling Egypt. So initially Yaakov passes out and he doesn't believe them. And then he goes outside and he sees wagons loaded with goods that only a king could afford to send. In those days, for centuries, the Egyptians would bring up cattle. They'd have cows that were so extraordinary, they would not let a cow leave Egypt without performing an operation to remove its womb. So no one could compete with their cows. No one could have cows like theirs. Yeshu, you heard of him, right? So Yeshu went to Egypt, and he worked on getting their cows out of Egypt. That was one of the things he tried to accomplish. The Talmud says he was crazy. There were all kinds of weird things he tried to do. So one of the things he did was that. When Yaakov sees the Egyptian cows standing out there, he knows that's a sign of royalty. No one else could get a cow out of Egypt. When he sees the wagons and the cows, and he sees, so Yosef sent all of these as proof. Yes, this isn't the game. I am still king. I am king and I'm here. And if we have some time, so tomorrow night we have to finish the parasha. There are a few more concepts to visit in the parasha as we conclude. To be continued, Bezachem, tomorrow night.